You're listening to Panel Borders, which is an extract from Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, I'm talking to Dan Berry, a lecturer on the New Illustration for Graphic Novels course at the North Wales School of Art and Design at Glyndŵr University. And I'm talking to him about the art of teaching comics and his own personal interest in the use of typography in the medium.
I first met you at the Northampton Graphic Novels Conference at their university a few weeks ago, and you gave a lecture on typography. How did that come about?
Well, typography, I think, is a subject that isn't really broached in academic discussions sometimes. And it's a fundamental part of comics. It's text and image, and it's the rules of typography and how they relate to the narrative and how it works with the artwork, and whether you're using a digital typeface or if you're using hand lettering. It's all this rich tapestry of interesting things to talk about. So that's it's something I find interesting. So it just came out from there, I suppose.
I mean, in terms of you actually being there to start off with, did Northampton get in touch with you, or had they sent out some kind of press release to various universities hoping to get people to talk on the subject?
I think it was it might have been forwarded on to me by Paul Gravett, who'd seen the conference, and I saw that they're asking for papers, and I thought, I've got a paper, I'll do that. Okay. And so
Oh, so you had written it already. You weren't thinking of a subject, you know.
You're making me sound quite prepared now. Not at all prepared. It's it was the sort of the beginnings of this idea that I'd had, that something I'd like to explore. Mm. But the thing is, as I did it, I found out more and more that, well, the more I found out there was to find out. So it sort of started to spiral out of control, and so I had to sort of rein it back in a bit, because it's an absolutely massive subject.
Mm. I mean, what sort of examples of typography sort of inspired you to write it in the first place? Because obviously there's your average comic book lettering, which varies in terms of font from character to character. But then you also have people like, for example, Will Eisner, who literally works the typography into the artwork, of his comic.
Yeah. I mean, where my interest in typography stemmed from, I was a researcher and designer after I graduated for a project with the university, and it was delivering digital media fundamentals to small businesses in Wales. So it was this huge project. I was in charge of delivering this module on design fundamentals. So we'd look at colour theory, we'd look at the basics of animation, and how to work digitally. And there was a big section on typography, and that really got me interested in actual typography. So it's one of my nerdy little pleasures of going past a shop window going, oh, that's Gil Sands, obviously. And that's Bodoni. And it's one of those nerdy things that people who really like type, it's one of those obsessive compulsive things that appeals to my obsessive compulsive side, I think.
I could go on to IMDb Pro right now and find out how much money the documentary Helvetica has made.
Yes. I've still not seen it. I keep missing it.
But the fact that got a cinema release shows that it's a subject that people have an interest in.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've got typographers like Eric Spiekerman. I've seen him speak, and you can talk on typography at great length and make it sound absolutely, startlingly interesting. It's a more interesting field than simply, dropping down a list and going Arial, which is it's basic. And in comics, there seems to be a tendency to say, "Oh, Comic Sans, that's a comic typeface," and
it's a font that's hated by most designers.
Yes, yeah, I've yet to find it. Well, meet the designer that really, really likes it. I think it doesn't have an air of finesse. Mm. I think that it's not a great typeface, I don't think.
But I don't think Comic Sans even looks that much like the way lettering is done in a comic. So no. I wonder how it came about in the first place.
It was designed by a guy who was working at Microsoft. They were... I can go into the story. Microsoft. They were doing this sort of fun... children's fun... I think it was some sort of comic maker or... It was just something in some comic style, and they were using Times New Roman for all the text. Mm. And being a typographer, he thought, "Well, that's incorrect use of type. That doesn't fit." And so he designed this this typeface, and I he did base it on the work of someone, and I can't remember who it is. I'm ashamed of myself. So he designed it for that specific purpose and forgot all about it. And then when I think Windows 98 was released, I might be wrong there, he found out that it was on the default system fonts list, and now it's on every computer on the planet, and it's used to sign people's email signatures in councils and yeah, stuff that makes you go yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, why would Times New Roman be a bad font to use in a comic? I mean, I can imagine it working well, say, in a noir comic.
You can say that there's no such thing as a bad typeface, just bad use of a typeface. But I think your choice of a typeface has got to be informed by the context in which you're presenting it. So in the the example you gave of a noir comic, yeah, it could be. That's don't have a problem with that. But the problem with the Times is because it's a serif typeface and it's got very delicate parts to it. At very small sizes, or if it goes on screen or something, it does start to break up slightly. And that there are, I think, better serif typefaces out there.
I mean, this is going to sound like a really asinine thing to say, but people have prejudices against various parts of an art form, and and comics in general put off a lot of people the way that they're constructed.
Yeah.
But I the reason I don't read more European comics is because whenever they're translated into English, the typeface they use is just clearly has been added by
copy and pasted.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's no hand lettering or anything, and it just really annoys me.
Oh, I can understand that. I think typography is it's an integral part of the actual comic. It's not. It's not something that's separate. It's like putting stickers all over your car. It's not part of the car, but it affects the way it's presented. It would be nice when these things are translated to actually hand letter them and go through and make sure that everything is perfect, rather than going Arial from the list or whatever. So,
Well, I mean, it's interesting that one of the areas of comics that's been a real boom industry of late is manga in the West. And when they translate that into English, regardless of whether they flip the art from left to right or not, they quite often leave the sound effects in Japanese in the background, but then translate the speech bubbles, as if the sound effects have such a, I don't know, presence in the strip that to remove them, it would lose part of the art as well.
I think in the example of manga and the this sound effect typography, I think that's... you don't even need to know what it's saying to get the gist of it. If it's a car rumbling past and you've got this, it's that noise. I think it would be it'd be patronising perhaps to try and translate and change it to whatever onomatopoetic description you'd use.
But at the same time, I suppose also gives it more the flavour of, say, a subtitled movie, that in there's still some of the original soundtrack, as it were.
I think I have actually seen an example of the sound effects sort of underneath each panel start or whatever, pow pow pow. I can't remember where it was, though. I might have even made that up, to be honest with you.
It rings a vague bell.
Yeah.
I mean, on a personal level, talking about lettering in comics, I recently came across Todd Klein's blog. He was the letterer on Sandman, I believe, and he's revered within the industry. And what he's been doing, I think he actually invented a lot of logos for comics over the years. And so on his blog, he's been investigating, say, the history of the X-Men logo, the way it's evolved over the last 40 years, and so on. And I found it absolutely fascinating. So I think, perhaps, you're touching on a subject that... for our listeners, Todd Klein, TODDKLEIN.
And that's on the internet.
It is indeed. Presumably you were a comics fan before you were a typography fan.
I grew up on the Beano and the Dandy, and then had a huge collection of Action annuals and war stories, and then I think as a teenager I sort of moved away. I didn't really I'm going to commit a little bit of heresy here and say I don't like superhero comics. That's I won't go into too much detail. I know people do, and I've got no problem with that. But I did I had friends that were into, you know, heavily into X-Men, and they'd talk at great length about which story arc is such and such and does such and such have such and such, and that's fine. I think there's room for that.
Here's a particularly good Todd Klein logo.
Oh, hello. New X-Men. That is quite nice, actually.
Because it works upside down and then way up.
Oh, that is clever. Well, yes, I might take a little photo of that later. just keep it on my computer or something. I've forgotten what we were talking about.
You were going off on one about superhero comics.
Yeah. I've forgotten the point. My personal history of comics. And so I'd sort of lost interest in comics. And then while I was doing my degree, I read Understanding Comics and Reinventing Comics, and I decided to start looking at digital comics. So I did my last year looking at interactive comics and how you'd make them interactive, and do you interact with your layout, or do you interact with the actual story itself, or do you have the artwork that's dynamic or static, or however that works? Do you all these big questions that I don't think there is an answer. Basically,
but more people should be asking the question.
But more people definitely should be asking the question. I think with this course that we're starting, that's one of the things I'd be very interested in seeing developing. But after my BA, I did an MA in interactive narrative, and looking at how to interact with a story, and it was the opportunity to try and have some fun with a story and with technology. So we were doing things with webcams and moving your arms around and having little people crawling over your outline and things like that. It was interesting. The college has started this degree in illustration for graphic novels. With the background I'd had looking at the way comics works, because I think to really make an interactive comic, you've got to really understand the nuts and bolts and the semiotics of comics and how they work, and how everything is contextual, and how absolutely everything has a knock-on effect of absolutely everything in a comic. It's a mind hurter to think about. So this course has sort of grown out of this illustration department we've got, who regularly go and win awards and Macmillan Book Prizes. I think we're joint first and third this year in the Macmillan Prize, which is very good. just thought I'd throw that in.
I was going to say, while we're on the subject, I mean, there does seem to be a big crossover between children book illustration and graphic novels. Yeah. I mean, from at the very least, Raymond Briggs' work, which is happy in either category in a bookshop, but also the fact that you have people who started off in comics moving on to children's book illustration and vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to be sort of flippant about it, you could say it was just the amount of drawings. Generally, if you're going to make rash, massive generalisations in a children's book, it's one picture per page and nice big handwriting. And of course, comics are lots and lots of tiny little pictures. That's a naive way to think about it.
Well, I don't know if anyone's ever come up with a reason why children's books aren't comics, except maybe that it's a ratio of text to drawing, that there's a tipping point. Once you have too much text, it's no longer a comic. Well, conversely, you can have a comic with no text, no whatsoever.
Yeah, I think with the children's illustration, each illustration takes up a larger space of time. So Amy wakes up and goes downstairs. Amy has this for breakfast. Amy does that. And they're very sort of brief staccato points in time. They're almost the key points of the narrative. Put in a graphic novel or a comic or whatever, you could have a nice little sequence of walking down the stairs, fastening a dressing gown around, finding some cereal in a cupboard. There's room to expand further. I think, I suppose, the level of sophistication of the reader's visual language in a comic has to be greater than that of a child. Although that's not to say that a child doesn't have enough sort of inherent visual literacy to read a comic. It's the visual formats that they work well. Regardless of your level of literacy, and that's a good thing about comics.
So did you actually go to NORSAD as a student?
I did, yes. I went to NORSAD as a student, yes.
And so when it came to the setting up of this course, I mean, were you involved in it, or did they approach former students?
I was quite heavily involved in actually writing the document, and I've been to visit the college in Angoulême and spoken to the lecturers there and seen how they run things, and that makes me sound like a spy, but I'm not. But it was nice to see that all the plans we'd laid down are basically rough approximation of the stuff they were already doing. So it was nice to see that confirmation that the model we thought was best did actually work and has been working for a number of years in Angoulême. So that was good. I think one of the main differences we found between us and Angoulême, the college in Angoulême is of a similar size. It's got a similar number of students, similar number of staff. The buildings look similar. You know, Wrexham and Angoulême are approximate sizes. You know, there's quite a good parallels to be drawn. But when we were speaking to the tutors there, I was speaking to Thierry Smolder, and he was saying that he's tried for years to try and bring in some creative writing aspects to this. The course there, but I think culturally in France you're either an artist or you're not. You know, you can't teach art, and so you can't teach creative writing. You're a writer or you're not.
Which that would seem to be at odds with their entire philosophy of cinema.
Yeah, it is
really, you know, the auteur theory and all.
Yeah,
that.
It's a really odd state of affairs. So they introduced the students these ideas of story archetypes and arcs and stuff, but it's not, you know, culturally seen as this. Something that can be taught or learnt, whereas I think in Britain I think we've got a very scientific approach to most things. Oh yes, you can take that apart, you can teach it, which, you know, I think to a certain extent is true. So we've got large parts of the course that are looking at story archetypes and how a story works and the use of plot devices and maybe stock characters or you know, how a story actually works, rather than focusing on, you know, the surface level gloss, which we do, you know, focus on as well, life drawing and media and techniques and why don't you try drawing with a biro, why don't you try and draw with charcoal, or, you know, why don't you smear it up a wall and see what happens. There's a lot of room for interpretation, I think, but it's got to be underpinned by this strong narrative theory. I think, because I read a comic for for the story, and if it's a bad story, regardless of how well it's illustrated, it's still a bad story. I think.
Well, I mean, I was going to say that surely any artist who works in figurative drawing, painting, or whatever, is telling a narrative of some sort or another, even if it's just within the one image.
Oh yeah, narrative can be applied to pretty much everything. But I think the idea of narrative and the idea of storytelling are slightly different things. That gets into quite a deep philosophical discussion, I think. It's one of those things that makes your head hurt to think about. But I think there are, you know, these archetypes in stories and people's expectations of a story. If you set something up, it needs to be completed, otherwise it leaves you hanging and it's not quite satisfying. And does he get the girl or does he not? Is it a comedy or is it a tragedy? Is it, you know? So there's a number of things to really explore there, because the theory of the seven basic plots says that Beowulf is basically the same as James Bond, is basically the same as, you know, with the characters have got different names, basically. So it is a rough generalisation. There are plenty of, you know, exceptions to the rule, but I think it's a good starting point.
In terms of other courses around the world, then, you investigated the one in Angoulême, and there's the famous there's Joe Kubert School in America somewhere that loads of illustrators went to.
The White River Junction Centre for Cartoon Studies. There's the ones in New York and San Francisco. There's a few that are looking at either sequential art or narrative illustration in Britain. Which are these big blanket terms. We're looking specifically at illustration for graphic novels and how a graphic novel works, and that's quite a distinct, focused way of thinking about it. But there's not very many people doing it. I think the tide's starting to turn, and I'll be delighted to see more courses coming about. I mean, that would be great. Giving people more opportunity to do things they like. I think I'm all for that. That's good.
How long's the course been going?
It's going to start in September.
So it's
all brand new, yes. So it's very exciting.
Presumably you've also thought ahead then of careers advice and whatnot, because I in this country, becoming a comic book writer artist would seem to be a lot more difficult than, say, in Europe or America or Japan.
Yes, yeah. I think one of the things that has come out of speaking to people and, you know, finding out what works and what doesn't work and best advice to give, it's been basically you know, don't give up your day job. it is a difficult field to, you know, excel in. But I found that a lot of the people that have come in for interview that we've accepted on the course already have got a compulsion to draw comics, and I think that a lot of comics people who do create are quite compulsive in their need to constantly produce. And I think having 3 years of sort of guidance and intuition is a good thing. But we do have we've got other courses that we run where people can, you know, have a look at computer games or interaction or animation. And I think a comic artist has to be very versatile in the way they work, but the skills that you get from actually practicing comics are cross transferable across all you know, number of things, games, film. There's a lot of, I mean, you have to be a designer, you have to be a typographer, you could be a photographer, you know. There's a lot of scope for doing a lot of different things, and I think it's not ruling any of them out. To support this singular vision that you might have of this grand space opera or whatever.
Well, I think, I mean, conversely, in America, they've got the exact opposite problem. There aren't enough new people entering the industry. So that I think the film department in NYU, for example, have a course where people who are struggling a little bit with their film studies will get coaching from Marvel how to write comics.
Wow. Well, that's quite a good idea, I think. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's where Jeff Loeb came from, for example. You know, so when it comes to sort of cross-disciplinary studies at NORSAD, there are lecturers who previously taught on the children's illustration course, and so on.
It's not replaced the children's illustration course. It's in addition to. I mean, the full rundown of courses is. I won't even try and do it alphabetically. I'll try and remember them all. But we do animation and we do moving image or creative lens media, which is anything through a lens. It's one of those lovely umbrella terms. We do interactive multimedia. We do general illustrations, this sort of more singular illustrations. We do the illustration for children's publishing. We do digital art for computer games. We do. I wonder if I'm going to get told off. I've probably forgotten a load of stuff. Oh, applied arts and, you know, ceramics and jewellery and glass and fine art. And so there's a huge range of courses that they do, and in the first year, I think the first 5 weeks, basically we lump everyone together and say try everything. I mean, because when you go to college, it's not always the case that everyone has a distinct idea of where their career is going to go, and, you know, they've got this focus. I mean, it's only by trying new things that you might go, I want to make teapots. That's, you know, I've got a real passion for ceramics. The Greeks did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it can be, because we're quite a small school, you can be relatively flexible in. I now hate comic books and I'd like to do fine art. That's entirely plausible, I suppose.
Do you need to have done a foundation course in art before applying, or is that sort of built into the first year?
You do have to. Well, it's a you know, full 3-year BA design degree, so there should either be the foundation degree or some, you know, stunning examples of portfolio work or something. But every interview we do is done on a sort of individual level. We, you know, go through portfolios and have chats to people and find out what they're doing. And I mean, if someone's talented, they're talented, regardless of what they've done previously.
Going back to what we started talking about then. Yes, back to typography. Yes. I mean, one of the examples that you brought up in your talk in Northampton was the work of Chris Ware, who's someone who very much uses typography, not just as a way of lettering his stories, but a way of structuring it on the page as well.
Yeah, he does. He's a very clever fellow. He can make you pick up a book and turn it round to try and read. I mean, he's controlling you by making you pick it up and move it around, and I think that's really clever. That's the way he actually uses typography. It's not this sort of fancy showing off, although it does, you know, it does look like showing off, and it is. But it fits within the story that he's creating, and I think it's in the Witch Acme novel to Libraries. I can't remember. I think it's on the first page. Whereas I just want to go to sleep and never wake up, and it's, you know, this terrible, you know, terribly oppressive, depressing piece about this girl who's really, you know, and it's sort of spiralling out of control into these tiny little pits of despair, and it's all done with, you know, pretty much nearly all done with typography, and it really does sort of stand up against this sort of critical analysis of it. I think that's it's a really good way to use typography, and it's not done so much, I don't think. I don't know.
I don't know what Chris Ware's background is. I mean, I have one of his early comics, The Adventures of Floyd Farlane or something that, which he's actually almost renounced and is trying to destroy every copy, like, you know, George Lucas and the Holiday Special. This introduction of typography and structure and design into his work, I mean, presumably that comes from him undertaking some kind of cross-disciplinary training, maybe in graphic design or architecture or something.
I'm sure it's influenced by a number of things. I know he's got interest in architecture and his love of all things old and fanciful, and a lot of his work is quite reminiscent of these, you know, old turn of the century comics in their elaborate flourishes, which seems to have been sort of wiped out and replaced with this almost in some cases minimalist style. But I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, decorative embellishment. I think that's it's really interesting, but I don't know if you've seen the Lost Buildings thing he did with Ira Glass for This American Life.
I've seen the animations.
The Lost Buildings was talking about, and I'm shocked at myself for not remembering this now, looking at the work of an architect in Chicago, and this guy's telling a story about how he loved these buildings, and it's all, you know, fancifully illustrated by Chris Ware, and the story's told by Ira Glass, and it's really interesting. It's comics in motion, I suppose, which then I suppose is a cartoon.
Well, have you read Ben Catcher's Real Estate Photographer?
Yes.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's a very good example of it.
Yeah, I like Ben Catcher a lot. I saw an exhibition of his work at the CNDBI in Angoulême, which was, that was really good. I do like Ben Catcher a lot.
But thinking of Chris Ware, I mean, hypothetically, if one of your students came up to you and said, I'm really interested in, say, the typography and design of Chris Ware's work, you could then point them in the direction of the graphic design department
We've got, staff that are willing to speak to anyone, really. I mean, they could come to me, they could go and visit the, graphic design lecturers, they could pretty much do what you like. I think if a project calls for something, go and find out, get some expert advice from someone.
That's the weird thing about, say, the American comic book industry, because it really is an industry that you have pencillers, inkers, colorists, letterers. The fact that it should, you know, reduce something that someone could do on a personal level, obviously not perhaps as prolifically, you know, into all these subgenres, that maybe that takes away some of the creativity that perhaps, like, as a filmmaker, you should learn to be able to do something, every aspect of your craft first, before sort of, farming it out.
Yeah, I agree. I think you've got to understand, you know, the nuts and bolts of how everything works. I mean, once you know the rules, you can start breaking the rules, or whatever. And I think this idea of carving up a comic into distinct jobs, in this production line sort of thing, it doesn't sit very well with me personally. I think it almost turns into this design by committee sort of model, and so I think some of the best examples of really well done graphic novels do come from this singular vision. Things like Mouse, that's, you know, would that be the same story if it was done with a group of people doing each step of the way? I don't really know, but I think if a team is working on one thing, it's got to be it's got to be a team. It can't be walled off or sent off to someone else to do this bit, to do that bit. The idea of working in teams to create comics is good, but they have to be that. They have to be teams, I think.
Well, and then you end up with absurd situations like this year's Eagle Awards, Dave Gibbons winning the prize for best letterer. I mean, I'm sure he's a very good letterer, of all the awards you could possibly give, Dave Gibbons, you know?
I agree. It's the idea of carving it up and assigning different parts, different, I don't know, is the letter more important than the such and such? Is what some person does on one job better than what someone does on another job? I think it's the end product that people see and not the process. In a lot of cases, I think this idea of carving it up is just a time-saving device to sell more comics, I think. Perhaps. Maybe I'm cynical, I don't know.
And regarding your course that starts in September, in terms of students signing up, presumably there are places still left, or if they think they might have to wait till clearing for their A-level or foundation results, or whatever.
There are places. There's also, we also take direct applications, so you can save your 30 quid UCAS fee or however that works. But we are taking applications for this year as we speak, taking applications. But yeah, we'll give people interviews and see what we think.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more info on Dan's course on illustration for graphic novels, please visit www.nwsad.com. And if you'd like to read Dan's lecture on typography that he gave at Northampton University earlier in the year, please visit www.panelborders.wordpress.com, where there are also links to previous installments of this show. Thanks for listening.